The Dickheads are presented in color.
Do you believe that the universe is irrational?
Pas et désirait séparer ce qui n'était pas de ce qui était. Le jumeau lié à terme franchit normalement les stades de son développement.
Hey, like a pink laser beam of truth beaming straight from Massachusetts, Ohio, and San Diego to your brain hole. We are your special dickheads today because we have two of your hosts, but we have probably the dickhead of greatest note on the planet, or one of them, and Bill Cyril, who not only knew Phil, but had a book dedicated to him, and he's sick to death of talking about Maze of Death, but you might recognize his name from it, because Phil dedicated the book to him. So, Bill, welcome back to the Dickheads podcast. If you want more of Bill's story when we get done, you can go listen to our Valis Incident panel, where he joined Tessa Dick and Ted Hand to talk about Phil's 1974 experience. Welcome back to the Dickheads podcast, Bill.
Thank you. I'm actually not really wearing a pink shirt. It's fuchsia.
Okay.
But I did wear it to the Valis performance a few days ago. So, I won't say the book Maze of Death was dedicated to me. I mentioned in the acknowledgement next to Bishop Pike, who, of course, became Timothy Archer in his last book. But it all stemmed from the time that I was living with Phil for about a month in Northern California. And we had one of these late night rap sessions. You know, he was a night owl. Mm-hmm. And it was like a couple of students in college in their dorm, you know, talking about theories of the universe and creating a theology out of thin air, out of just some basic concepts of ontology and teleology. And a few months later, he called me up and said, hey, you know, I've written a book about it. And it came out, it was Maze of Death. It came out actually in 1970. He told me, I think it was in December of 68 that he told me he'd written that up, which means he was a fast writer, of course.
And,
So we remained friends for the rest of his life, and I was witness indirectly to some of the events in Valis. So I have a bit of a perspective on what went on, and I'm certainly familiar with the book. I mean, my own personal opinion about the book is that the first part of it is one of the most brilliant things he wrote, because he was writing what was real, totally real. The invented parts having to do with Brent Minnie and the Lamptons didn't resonate quite as strongly with me, but I have to say that in this opera version that I saw at MIT a few days ago, the Lamptons I thought were brilliantly portrayed and really came across as real people, and costumed in punk outfits with black leather. it was great to see them actually being visualized.
Well, we'll get into the opera in a bit, but one other question I have before we get into this is, you met Phil because you were a part of the science fiction community going way back, and I think some of our listeners would also be interested in the fact that, you know, for me, like, one of my favorite authors is John Bruner, and, you know, like, I'll mention, like, a John Bruner book, you'll be like, yeah, I had dinner with that guy, and I seethed with jealousy at your time in the site.
I'm just lucky. I had a number of connections that were sort of materialized out of thin air. I used to know Isaac Asimov once from the time I interviewed him when I was a teenager in high school back in the 50s, and we remained friends for a while. And then I when I moved to, I was a friend of Paul Williams, who was became the executive for estate, for Dick's estate, and published, helped facilitate the publication of a number of his books, especially Confessions of a Crap Artist. But I, Paul and I mean, I knew Paul when he was like 14 or 15 years old, because we were from neighboring towns and science fiction fans. And I met Dave Hartwell back then when I was 20 and he was 21. So it goes back, we go back a long way with the science fiction community. And then Paul and I both went to California in 1968 to BACON, the World Science Fiction Convention, where we both met Phil Dick. And I had corresponded briefly with Phil before then because I was, I mean, his writing was unique. There was no other science fiction writer of that era who was writing anything like what he did. I mean, it was that mainstream influence that even though a lot of it was about his conflicts with female figures, you know, which can be interpreted today as misogyny, it was nevertheless real in a way that other science fiction wasn't. And I was powerfully drawn to this combination of wild imagination plus something that sounded mainstream or realistic. So I was corresponding with him, and then I wound up, I was a graduate student in physics at Boston University at that time. And I'd won a National Science Foundation fellowship to attend a summer seminar in theoretical physics at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And afterwards, I had to make a decision about whether I was going to go home, hitchhike to Chicago and protest the Democratic National Convention, or hitchhike out west to go to the World Science Fiction Convention. I'm happy to say I made the right choice.
Yeah.
Because it changed my life forever. And I probably would have gotten my head broken in if I'd gone to Chicago. But I met Phil at BACON, and he immediately invited me to live with him.
And, yeah, and one last general question, we'll get into the Valis opera.
Yeah.
I think for people also that, I think I'm getting into Professor Wilson's head here, but as a person who knew Phil, what do you, I know this is a kind of a big question, but how do you process like the fame that he has gotten after his death and the scholarship that has arisen from, you know, his work? Like, I think, you know, it's really fascinating to think about and sad that he didn't get to see it. But as your, as his friend, how do you process that?
I, you know, he was a prophet and probably a precog as well. On some level, he always, you know, he was denied the kind of attention and fame he would have liked, and only got it very late in his life, and only got a little taste of it. And even when Blade Runner came out, it still took 10 years or more before he started getting some cachet in Hollywood and elsewhere. But there's no question he anticipated much of the present world. And it's, and including all of, including its paranoia, its conspiracies, it's the notions around a whole range of notions having to do with AI on one hand and the surveillance state on another, and also a literal divine invasion, at the re-enchantment of the world, you know, a spiritual call. I think he was a spiritual mentor to a lot of us in the early 60s, Paul Williams, me, and other friends of ours, who were influenced by, for example, A Man in the High Castle, which was our introduction to Carl Jung, to Taoism, and to the I Ching. I mean, that was, that had a powerful effect. So he was, in a sense, I call him Saint Phil because he's like this this imperfect saint, in the same way that Sartre called Jean Genet, you know, a saint. He brought something special into the world, as flawed and as damaged as he was. I'm not calling him crazy. I think he was very sane in many ways, but definitely he was damaged goods. And really, as we all are, I mean, he really spoke about the kinds of alienation that each individual can have about the impact of. I think in one of his books he describes the family, its parents, as like fish in the sea banging into the their offspring. We've all been we're all in this ocean in which we've been influenced by psychic forces that have shaped our world and shaped us individually, and now we're dealing with this worldwide mess that has got to be cleaned up. So it's a great time for the reappearance of Sophia or some other aspect of holy wisdom that can restructure our world. And I think that was his looking for a savior is really what that's about. And you see that in his Tagore letters, anticipating he was talking about environmental pollution from nuclear activity. Well, we have a lot more than that to worry about now. But I think he was a prophet in that regard too. And the key part of this is he wasn't a pessimist, although he certainly battled pessimism at times. It was also the sense that he believed in something. He believed that the world could be saved, renewed in some fashion. And that's really, I think, the key to understanding him. In the midst of all this darkness, there's the possibility of hope, of grace, of renewal, of rejuvenation. And that's really what Ubik is all about, even though at the end he pulls the rug out from everybody's feet. So,
Can I just say one thing and then a biographical question if I might, Bill? It's one thing I'm discovering as I get more and more immersed in the Philip K. Dick community. You know, everybody's drawn to him and his literature for kind of different reasons, but almost invariably, especially for a proper dickhead, it in some way informs their identity. There's something about PKD that kind of rubs off on people.
Yes.
When you were, this is, that's just kind of a follow-up to what you were saying, but when you were younger interacting with these various science fiction folk, like Williams and you mentioned Hartwell and some other people, what were your ambitions at that time? Were you just a fan? Were you a, did you want to be a journalist? Or was it all, you're a scientist, right? Did you always?
Well, I was a fan. I was also a bit of a Renaissance man, and so I was a critic. I was started writing around 1963 and contributed to, in fact, I became a film and music critic for a paper that ultimately became the Boston Phoenix before it died about 2013. I'm sorry, 2013. So the Phoenix actually was a great hotbed for developing writers. Other people who wrote for them went on to considerable acclaim as critics, Janet Maslin at the New York Times, Owen Gleiberman, David Thompson, a whole range of different authors passed through there. Stephen Schiff, who became a writer, and then a critic, a film reviewer, and then actually started writing films. So it was a great place to learn and practice writing. I was involved early on, but I was also a graduate student in physics, so I loved cinema, I loved music, and I wrote about them whenever I could. It was a great way to get in free to see different shows. But I didn't pursue the writing per se, although I developed my writing chops doing that kind of journalism. I learned how to write for a paper that didn't pay anything, but eventually, you know, grew into something substantial. So the last piece I wrote for the Phoenix before they died was in October 2012, when I reviewed the PKD conference at San Francisco State that David Gill had organized. And I wrote up, the paper asked me to write a 600 words about my friendship with Phil. There's no way I could fit that into 600 words, but they accepted 800 and put it in smaller type. And that's what you'll see is Philip K. Dick was a friend of mine. That paper that's available on Academia, I copied. I made sure that copies would be available after the paper went down. So,
And it's a great article. So tell us the story about how you ended up at this performance.
I missed the performance that was held at MIT in 87. Now, the story was originally, it was commissioned by the Pompidou Center in Paris at the AIRCOM, the I forget what AIRCOM stands for. It's something about the Consortium for Acoustics and Music. It was International Research. That's IRCAM. And it was performed there, and that's what the recording that you can still find, even on YouTube, was recorded through that performance. I missed seeing it or hearing it in 87 when it played in Cambridge. And so when I saw Cliff's announcement that copying you, that it was playing that very weekend in Cambridge, and I figured, oh no, I've missed it again. And I checked it was free. All the tickets had been given out. So what I wound up doing is, out of desperation, I posted a request on Everything Is Free page from in my town, Arlington, which is not even where I think I could find a ticket, because, you know, it wasn't Cambridge, even though it was Cambridge adjacent. And I described the situation and asked if anyone knew of a ticket or had a ticket or whatever. And the second person who responded was a friend of Todd Macover's, the composer's. And she put me in touch with Todd. And Todd said, go talk to my assistant, Clemence, which I did. I sent her all the information. I have a number of other connections with Todd, which is curious. It's all synchronicity. So I wound up getting in. I got myself a prime seat, and it worked out very well. And also, I got a chance to talk to Todd and the singers and people, the producer and the director afterwards. A lot of them are really fascinated by Philip K. Dick, and they want to know how to become dickheads. So I said, you already are.
Yeah.
But they want to connect with the community. So there's some people who will be joining, I'm sure, the various groups. But so the curious part about this, the synchronicities involved, is that the woman who lived in my town, who was a friend of Todd Macover's, turned out to be someone who was a close friend of friends of mine who'd been roommates 50 years ago, and who also were friends of with Paul Williams. And the irony is that back in 2012, when I was wrote up that review of the San Francisco State Philip K. Dick Conference, I was staying with those same friends that I lived with 50 years before, but now they were in El Cerrito, California. And I'm walking down from their house to San Pablo Avenue, and there's a sidewalk grate in the sidewalk that somebody has written Vallis on. That was in 2012, I found. So at that time, I commented, I'm being pursued by memes of Philip K. Dick. But now the connection is even more deeply interwoven with these people who, my old roommates being connected to the woman who connected me to Vallis. So it's just, it's what Will Morgan calls synchromysticism. And synchronicity plays a very big part, of course, in all of Phil Dick's work, and especially in Vallis. One of the things I wanted to comment on was, there are reasons why you can see why Vallis, the book, would be of interest to Todd Macover as an experimental composer. For one of them is the notion of Brent Minnie, who is modeled in some sense after Brian Eno. But Phil describes Minnie in Vallis as Kevin Jeter saying, does Minnie mean Brent Minnie anything to you? He did the music. Minnie works with computer created random sounds, which he calls synchronicity music.
Right. So, well, this is one of the questions that I have directly for you on this is, like, what do you think Phil would have thought of the opera? I think he would have been more into this than he would have been a lot of the films, especially the films that turned into action movies, which probably would have, like, I don't know how Phil would have felt about, Total Recall, for example. Even though I'm a fan of Total Recall,
I know. Yeah,
and also,
I know what you mean. However, but I thought there were maybe 5 or 10 minutes of Total Recall, which were really right on. But I doubt he would have liked the whole movie. I think he would have liked the opera. I think it would have captured his inner sense of what the music should sound like. just the same way that when he saw the rushes for Blade Runner of the scenes in, you know, I guess L.A., he thought, yeah, that's what my inner vision was. He really captured it, even if the rest of the movie was a diversion from what he'd originally written, and he didn't care for it. But the he liked the visuals the same way I think he would have liked the music in the opera. So it's in a way, it's a shame he never got to hear it, because it would be kind of a realization of his own inner vision or own inner sounds. And I think he would have been entranced with the way the Lamptons were portrayed, at least in the version that I saw.
What was the opera, like the first thing that came to my mind is, you know, why not, for instance, a play or a popular musical? Why an opera? Was Todd the one that wrote it?
Well, he describes it, and I, you know, I'm still planning. We have to get together. He wants to meet me, and I want to ask him questions about it. From what I've read, the description was that he was living in Paris at the time. You know, he spent about 7 years there at IRCAM. And developing new music. And he has an interesting background because he's both technologically oriented and in terms of experimental sounds, but also has a real harmonic sense. I mean, he's got a background. He studied under Roger Sessions and Elliot Carter, great prominent musicians. He wanted to bring something of the musicality and the of Charles Ives, for example. He wanted to realize that. So he's brought up this, I think his father was involved with computers. His mother was a pianist. He played the cello, but he also played in a rock band. So he's got this diverse aspects, Todd Machover did. And he was in Paris apparently looking for a book on technology and humanity. And as he describes it, Vallis fell into his hands. And he got more than he bargained for. That was his quote. So it seemed like it's almost like he was looking for something, and then he found it, and then found even more than he'd been looking for.
Right. And another thing about opera is we wouldn't have Phil the science fiction writer, I think, without opera, because it was the conversations over opera between him and Tony Boucher at the record store in Berkeley that, you know, kind of sparked their friendship. And Phil has said many times that he had kind of felt he had grown past science fiction until he met Tony Boucher and saw, like, here's a respectable guy who I like, who's not writing kids stuff. He's writing really great science fiction. And, you know, now we have what we have. And so I think opera plays a role in Phil's story, not just
in the sense of spirituality. Also spirituality. He used to talk about Tony Boucher and himself as being the, at least he told me this, the two religious nuts in the Bay Area.
That's hilarious. And I think Tony, one of the things too that I learned from just like walking around Berkeley too, was that record store that he worked at was a very short walk from Tony Boucher's house. So I imagine that, you know, he was in the record store a lot, and they had a lot of, because I know Phil had that kind of agoraphobia about going to the Thursday night workshops, but that didn't mean that Phil didn't have, a connection to him in that regard. But anyways, back to this.
Well, opera. I did want to mention one thing about opera, since you mentioned that. Phil learned to really appreciate Wagner, but in particular Parsifal. And Parsifal, I believe, is mentioned in Vallis, but it's also as a theme in some of his, at least in the exegesis and in some of his other works, where he, you know, it's the pure fool who becomes enlightened in a sense, but it's also, you know, through a journey. But it's also his very important concept about time becoming space, that he repeats throughout some of his works. And really, the exegesis, a lot of that is about time, the nature of time. So the Parsifal, apparently Todd Machover said he was greatly influenced by Parsifal to include it in some fashion in this opera. I saw there was a scene in which the Horse Lover Fat, was it him or, okay, I'd have to consult my notes. It could be the woman who's portraying Gloria is reading from the score to Parsifal, and there are references to it in the text. But clearly Parsifal played a role from what Todd McIver has said, and also from what I could see in the production. It was another influence. So that's a Phil Dickian influence that got really well conveyed, I think.
And now you were saying that you thought that the recording is actually just purely listening to the recording, it might be a better experience than seeing it live. What did you mean by that?
Let's say this. First of all, I think the music is brilliant. I think Todd McIver is a remarkable, remarkable composer, that he's able to make something very highly listenable and understandable and comprehensible. But the production that I saw was somewhat incomprehensible, even though I was familiar with the story. I talked to Lloyd Schwartz, who's a Pulitzer Prize winning a critic, who was actually followed me as a critic for the paper that became the Boston Phoenix. And he was as confused about parts of it as I was. Even though he liked the music. So it's, I think the problem is this: you couldn't print the whole libretto, which is adapted from the book, including chunks of it that are literally quoted word for word. You couldn't print the whole libretto in the program book. And at least in the recording, you've got the original recording, you have like a 64-page booklet with a lot of detail, and so you can follow along exactly who's singing what. Part of the confusion in the new production was that the director, Jay Scheib, who's the director of, I guess, theater at the Media Center, wanted to do something a bit experimental. And what he did was, just like Horse Lover Fat and Philip K. Dick are two sides of the same person, the person doubled in effect. He doubled many of the characters there. So Sophia, who appears as a spiritual figure, an angel at the end, also shows up at the very beginning narrating the thing. Whereas if, at least in the production I saw, where if you listen to the original recording, the narration is done by the actor or the singer who actually plays Horse Lover Fat. Also, nowhere in the program notes was it explained what the relationship between Horse Lover Fat and Philip K. Dick was. It was, I mean, I didn't see it. So, I mean, it left to, why Fat? Why, you know, we know why, but I'm not sure it was made clearly enough. That point was established clearly enough in the booklet that was handed out. But
Bill, what was the theater itself like? Was it a big, like what was the capacity for
the
audience?
No, it was a small theater with, you know, ranked rows of seating. So it was, I had a very good seat in the third row near the edge where I could get it. You know, one of the producers put me there, a producer, so I could get the best view of where most of the action was occurring.
I see.
And it was, and had some problems with it. Part of the problem is this. Remember, this is MIT. It's the Media Lab. And they do experimental things. Some of the experiments are wonderful with the with sound, with the hyper instruments, where you can play something monophonically and electronically be converted to something symphonic, for example, you know. But and they did have a new concept that I'll tell you about later with regard to what Mini did about the synchronicity music. It was really, that was right on. But what the theater design was, it was not entirely satisfactory. It's kind of a small, to me, kind of a small theater. In the original Pompidou production in France, apparently they did away with scenery and just had towers and, you know, television sets and towers or screens or whatever. So the whole thing was kind of done bare stage, but with all electronic effects. There was something similar done here, but it was a bit more elaborate. There were rooms shown as depicted with walls that were made of aluminized mylar, that could be either reflective or you could see through depending on who was behind them. And a lot of video camera work. So what does that mean? It means the director himself, because the cameraman had sprained his ankle, so the director himself was on stage, participating with the other artists, but holding a video camera so that you could follow them both on stage and on a couple of TV sets and on a big screen up to the left. The screen was intended to look like a cloud, so it did not give totally clear images, but things were a bit distorted, and the TV sets just showed whatever was being projected. Now, in the book, TV does play a role, because messages like the King Felix cipher are conveyed that way. And there's also, at the end, Horse Lover Fat is just sitting in front of his TV waiting and watching for his commission, for the word of the next savior, the returning savior, the fifth savior to come back. So TV had to be a part of it. But the way it was done, I thought, was obtrusive. My personal reaction, I mean, experimentally, it was interesting. Was it successful? I don't know. I commented to the director that because all the he was dressed in black, and there were some other stagehands all in black who participated in the action. I commented it reminded me of those sort of backstage assistants at kabuki, Japanese kabuki theater, who are dressed completely in black, including masks over the face, and on a dark stage, you're not really supposed to notice them. It says they're invisible, moving stuff around in the background. But here, even though he's dressed in black, but he's right up front and center holding a video camera, interacting with people, and it was anything but unobtrusive. It was just highly visible. And it didn't entirely work for me. That's all I can say.
Did you get a sense that it was intended to be metadramatic? Or was the director on stage, for instance, for the benefit of the screens overhead? Like, was he trying to be self-reflexive?
Well, don't forget, the director wasn't supposed to be on stage himself. It was supposed to be a cameraman who had sprained his ankle. But there's definitely a meta quality to it, and it broke the fourth wall. So I found it difficult to immerse myself fully in what the story was, even though, you know, because there's this guy, not just the guy, other actors, other singers would be wandering around with video cameras too, showing scenes in back rooms that I question the relevance of. There are scenes with someone there's a back room with a bathtub and a toilet, and someone's constantly getting into and out of the bathtub and wiping yourself down with a towel, fully dressed. And I was like, what is this about? How is this? And why is this being projected on a television set on the side? I mean, what is the relevance? Or on the screen? It's just. But I shared a photo with David, which shows I couldn't really take pictures during the production itself, but before it started, I shared a photo with there was a pile of kipple on the floor. If you all remember what kipple is, you know, just sure.
Was it replicating? Did they manage to do that?
No, but it was in a sense, because it was someone had set up a TV camera in front of it. The director set up a TV camera in front of it, and you could see its replica on the big cloud-like screen. So it was, Kipple was reproducing in the cloud, which somehow is a real metaphor for our current age.
So... Are they planning, was this like a one-time show?
It was a one-shot, but who knows what. I think what they're planning on doing is taking it to, I think Todd said, to China next. God knows what the Chinese will make out of it. But it was, there were some parts I thought were very effective, and I don't want to put this piece down. I had problems with the visuals. That's why I said, listen to the recording. It's a really wonderful piece of music. It's just that because of the fact that actors doubled parts, and you're not quite sure who's playing what, who's supposed to be singing what, especially without a libretto, it's a bit hard to follow, and all this video stuff going on. The pink beam was, I thought, effectively portrayed. there was a series of what looked like doorways that are made out of light tubes, LEDs or whatever, that can flash in different colors. At the moment of what he called the pink beam explosion, you didn't see a beam of light hitting the singer's head who was playing Horse Lover Fat. What you saw is that these frameworks or doorways of light, constructed of light tubes, would suddenly turn bright pink and or flash back and forth. And I thought that was an effective moment, as the guy, poor guy, is clutching his head and wondering what's going on to him. The singers were all really terrific. There was a Devonay Tynes. So I have to comment, this is not intended to be a exact replica of the book or a replica of anything relating directly to Philip K. Dick or what he looked like or acted like. You know, this is not a movie in which you're getting Paul Giamatti to play Philip K. Dick, although I'd still like to see that movie if it ever comes out. So there's, as with a contemporary opera, they can draw on any singer who's really talented. It doesn't matter what their ethnicity is. So you wind up with a black performer, Devonay Tynes, playing Horse Lover Fat. I had no problem with that. I mean, you see that at the Metropolitan Opera all the time. You know, black characters, more black singers appearing. The woman who was, I have to look up her name, who played Sophia and the narrator, I thought was absolutely wonderful singer, was also black. I think the important thing is to focus on the singer. And the other, the one problem I had, there's a basso profundo, really deep bass, playing Dr. Stone. You remember Dr. Stone is the doctor at the Orange County Medical Center, who prescribes Bach flower remedies to Phil. Phil says they pronounce Bach, but I spoke to somebody who's a Bach, but I spoke to somebody who's a, who speaks Welsh, and she says no, it's Bach, just like the composer. Anyway, you couldn't really understand, or I couldn't really understand more than a few words of what this guy was singing, because his voice is so, so deep. But what I did catch was that he was introducing Phil to these flower remedies, but he just gave him a bag of powder, not a little bottles.
Very deep
with
voice. Yeah.
And then was introduced him to Lao Tzu, was reading him to him. That's in the early part of the book. So a lot of this was taken directly from the book, and a lot was left out. The character Kevin does not appear at all. But what I thought was most successful about it, the singers were all terrific, and especially I thought the Lamptons, these two singers who performed, Linda and Eric Lampton, were just, I thought, fabulous and properly. They were attired just exactly right. It made them come alive as characters, not just, you know, I couldn't really visualize them in the book, but I thought they was perfectly done for this. The other thing that was noteworthy, in the original production in 87, Minnie appears, although I'm not sure he says anything. He just conducts music. And, you know, all of this performance was conducted and by Machover himself, all the way over in one side of the stage. The instrumentation were piano, a xylophone, and a variety of electronic devices. And this time, they did something new. Now, the difference between this performance and the one in the Pompidou Center in 87 is that, or the what you can hear on the recording, is that they've substantially improved some of the electronic sounds. So, you know, as you can imagine, media has advanced considerably since the last almost 40 years, and especially with what's coming out of MIT. And in this way, and again, Phil Dick was a prophet, you know, the synchronicity music, but also the he described it, his influence on AI in particular, made Phil Dick a real hero at the Media Lab. So what they did is, that was unique, a graduate, former graduate student, Nina Maswali, I think her name is, had come up with a concept for a device that could play synchronicity music. And it looked like a mason jar filled with lights, Christmas lights, whatever. And it there were sensors in there. So depending on how she turned it or held it, it would produce random music, synchronicity music, that was modulated by somebody on a laptop computer nearby. So instead of having Minnie, the composer appear as Minnie, which I think would have been kind of neat, they had this woman appear as Minnie. So in another, we have Brent Minnie undergoing sex change. But the point is that this whole notion of an AI-controlled device that would react spontaneously to the environment, depending on how it was held or used, that was both a realization of Minnie's synchronicity music, and at the same time, right on the forefront of experimentation of what was coming out of the Media Lab, which is what the Media Lab is really good for. They're defining new structures, new standards for performance, not just in this opera, but it could be used anywhere. And so that was exciting to see, but confusing, because there's no understanding of who is this person? Who is this woman wandering around on stage with a jar full of Christmas lights? You know, no explanation. And I had to infer it after the fact by seeing who was doing what. And that's why I think the audience was left a little bit confused. Their applause was substantial, put it that way. I thought as I said, I thought the singing performances, all of them were done. The singers were fabulous. Sopranos, mezzo, and bass baritone, and this basso profundo, just terrific.
The racial dimension you mentioned is really interesting. To my mind, Phil was very much a Caucasoid, and for better and for worse, comes out in the literature. Were they professional actors or affiliated with MIT?
Professional singers, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
They have quite a list of, I've got the program book here. I could, at some point I can quote, or I'll send, Dave, would you like to, which Dave am I talking to? Would you like to receive it?
You can send it to either of us.
You want a copy of the program book? Yeah, I'll send you one if you want as a souvenir of this. You can put a photo of it up or even show a picture. I can still get photos from the press office of the various performers.
Yeah, please
performers,
do. Yeah.
I would love that.
Whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
I know it's confusing. Get one of those? There's so many Davids involved in dickheadism. So,
especially as well. That's right.
I mean, with Lord Running Clam, at least we have that to call him, so we don't have to get into the, you know. Right. And at least you're a Bill, so that helps.
Right. Okay.
But listen, I know the listeners are going to be throwing stuff at me because I'm the one that has to wrap things up. But we'll have Bill back just to chat, Phil, I'm sure, at some point in general. But we just wanted to get quick first thoughts on seeing it because you know, you were the one that got to do that. And you know, and I really appreciate you hopping on this morning and doing that because behind the scenes, everybody, I hit Bill with this last night, so so I was really glad he was able to do that, to do this and talk to us. Is there any last thoughts you want to give about the opera before we go?
I'm glad that I got to see it because I'm not sure I'd ever get to see another production of it again, put it that way. It's a rare event. And seeing it, hearing it, I should say, more than seeing it in this renewed production was quite special. So I'm grateful, and grateful for any work done behind the scenes that may have helped get me in.
And I just want to put a word out there that I think they need the jug band from the Simulacra in the next one. And Professor Wilson and I might be pretty sensitive on the race thing because we just read The Man Whose Teeth Are All Alike for the next episode, which is not one of Bill's more progressive works on that issue. So we may be particularly sensitive right now on that.
One last question. Did you say, was it actually film to be, will it be available on YouTube or anything like that? Or it was, that was all part of
there was it. I don't know. I asked the cameraman sitting next to me who was shooting the whole thing. We were just saving the whole performance on video, what was going to become of it. And he didn't really know. When I speak to Todd Machover, I'll find out more.
Okay.
So yeah. It would be interesting if we could see it the way it was shown. Other than that, you just have to rely on, you know, a few pictures. And there were a couple of articles about it in local publications, in the Boston Globe and in the Boston Musical Intelligencer. You can look both of those up. But they weren't reviews so much as interviews with Todd Machover describing the production before it started. I really don't know what other critics thought of it, other than, as I said, running into Lloyd Schwartz at the performance, and whose opinions seemed to match mine. You know, really wonderful musically, and a little more than a little confusing for anyone not initiated into the world of Philip K. Dick, and even for me, without a libretto, like who's doing what and why are they doing this? Anyway, yeah. So let's hope maybe it will be out on video and things will become more transparent.
And we would love to have Todd on too, so you can send him our way too. We'd of course think sure. That's important. So for all the dickheads that are out there, if you want more Bill Cyril, and who wouldn't, you can find him on our panel on the Valis incident with Tessa Dick and Ted Hand. So again, I highly recommend that. We'll put the link to that episode in our show notes. That is a really fantastic episode that can give you a lot of insight into the real life incident that inspired both the book and the opera. So that's key to this story as well. So Bill, do you want people to find you or no?
What a question. If anyone finds me, you're welcome to me.
Okay. So, well, Bill's very active in the PKD fan group. So if any of our listeners are out there on Facebook in the PKD fan group, you will find.
Yeah. On my own personal page, I don't usually accept friend requests from people I haven't directly interacted with or know personally. I just get overwhelmed with too many. I'm not into collecting people, but but I, you know, anyone in our community who I have a relationship with, I certainly accept friendships. But, you know, better to find me on the PKD fan page or the Phil Vickian, the Zach Woods page, where I occasionally comment. So, all right, great. Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah. I always love talking to you, Bill. All right. Well, folks, we'll talk again soon. So as always, dickheads, keep it paranoid. Stay paranoid.
Take care.